we just hear with those tuning pegs? See, I can't even remember anything. What's the name of that tune?
Four Piano Parts.
Four Piano Parts. All right.
Parts for four pianos? Or four...
It's actually several hundred piano parts.
It's a descriptive piece in the score. Now, how does a piece like this... and this is important because we were talking about this on the way up. And some pieces... that we have heard over the past many years date very rapidly. Mm-hmm. How does this piece, which in many ways represents a kind of a, you know, clusters of sound and random events that are built into how the sound is made, how do these hold up as works of art over time?
Do you want to ask me that in 20 years?
Well, I mean, look, none of us are so delighted with our mortality that we don't want to have everything disappear immediately, or we wouldn't write it down for someone else.
I don't know. I think this piece is there's a score for this piece. There's already some sort of longevity built into the piece, or some potential longevity built into the piece, which isn't the case with some. Let's be careful with what I say about this, but with some electronic pieces that are being done today, where they're built up and prepared for a very specific performance. The patch is maybe never completed by the composer because it's always a composer who performs it. Those kind of pieces are most definitely, the majority of those pieces are going to be lost. The other side of it is that it was never necessarily the intention of that composer to have that piece, have this be remain as an object, as an art object. So let's say it has to do with the time, the place, what they were working on at that point. So it was geared towards that one performance, and if the performance went well, then that's sufficient. And if you have documentation of it, then there's at least documentation you can listen to what was being done then. But yeah, I mean, it'll be more and more of a problem, specifically with electroacoustic works.
Well, that's partly why you're in the process here with the CEC of launching this sort of a preservation event in a way.
Yeah, I mean, in our case, it's a mechanical problem. It's that the tapes are deteriorating and they'll eventually not be readable at all. We were very lucky. The collection was in a very, very good shape. It somehow survived a flood in one of the rooms that it was stored in at one point, and being sort of neglected for a number of years as they tried to find a place to store it. But it was in excellent shape. We really couldn't have been luckier with this. There were, I think, so far of all the pieces that we transferred, like two pieces that we couldn't recover. One was recovered, but the noise in it was just so incredible that it just couldn't be resolved. And another one, the tape was put on the machine and sort of
peeled off.
Yeah,
in there.
So it's very mechanical, the problem in our case. As you get into the works of the, let's say, the late 80s and especially through the 90s, then it becomes a problem of archiving. It's a real archiving problem where you don't know how the composer did this, and let's say the patch doesn't work from an early Max piece, or is the software available? And I know this is something that you've talked about at length in various places, and you have quite a bit on the site, I think, about...
I do. It's been a big concern of mine is how do we take this kind of technological bubble we've got now? In 20 years, we're going to be able to emulate stuff. We can't emulate when you don't have the source functioning to start with. And so we're in this kind of bubble of when the first tape started to appear until serious emulation is in place, where we're in danger of losing a generation or two of particularly sonic art.
Yeah. It'll be recovered when there's a body or a person who makes the effort to do it. So I did a concert with a friend of mine, Chinua Anderson, a flutist out east. We coordinated a concert together, and she wanted to do some flute and electronic pieces. Each of the pieces had a different setup. We had to have a G5 and a G4 running for one piece. We had to get a pitch rider. It was so specific, all of this stuff. And it's fine if you have this. You have this pitch rider and you have this and that. And of course, we discovered the pitch rider was old and had been sitting around in the warehouse, and it didn't work. And we were lucky that the composer actually made it down for the concert and brought all his own equipment. And she was going to play a piece by Kaya Sayao, and then had problems because we were supposed to be running, what was it? I think the G5 had to run OS 10 and the G4 had to run OS 9. And, I mean, it was just ridiculous.
I know.
Pieces almost got canceled because they simply, we couldn't get everything to work together.
And that is with equipment which has kind of a history. I mean, we have some pieces, or particularly I have some pieces which are gone pretty much because they were written for computers that were before there was any standardization at all. I wrote several pieces that ran only on a synthesizer which was made in 1973, interfaced with a computer that was last manufactured in 1979. And those pieces cannot be recovered at all.
Not without proper documentation of what was done at the beginning, but because when you're dealing with sound or you're dealing with compositional ideas, people don't always, you know, okay, oh, I just turned this knob to this. And, I mean, I actually did that when I was doing Duo, and I've never looked at the patch diagrams ever again. I thought, well, I'm going to try and document
these
this.
These are big physical sheets of paper?
Well, no, I had a sheet of paper, and each night when I was working in the studio, I would simply document the patches that I was using on the Ares synthesizer, the modular synth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, it was great because I actually discovered when I finally got, you know, all night I'd been, oh, this is really subtle, this one. And at the end I would find out that the thing wasn't really patched into anything. You find all these, like, redundant patches. And I used all the cables usually for all the patches. So I tried to document all of it. I could, in theory, go back and rework these patches. But because of the nature of analog synthesis, I would never get the same sounds. And is that unit going to be available that I ran the things through for some reverb or some flanging or whatever I used on the thing, is that going to be available? So it would be possible to document it, but actually to reconstruct it is also another problem. I wanted to mention the Sarajevo simply because, just briefly, we couldn't get the thing to work. You had to just... external equipment, there was this particular unit you had to have, and we just looked at it and said, oh, this is impossible. And it was there were several pieces on the program that almost got cancelled, and we contacted the publisher, and they, like, sent by FedEx a CD, the thing, the all of the configuration for the reverb and everything had been built into a Max standalone patch, so we were able to perform the piece. And for Max, for OS 10, I think by that point. In that case, it was a publisher that took on the work of actually doing that.
That's a dedicated publisher there, that's for sure. Because,
but it's a dedicated publisher with a recognized composer.
Absolutely.
So there's thousands and thousands of pieces that are simply going to disappear.
It's going to be an interesting archival question in a couple of generations. Because there's already, you know, the search back for how pieces were done, even Cajun pieces were done. He was very good at identifying how to do pieces. But as we move far and further and further away from understanding directly the impact on performers and audiences of many of those pieces, and particularly the pieces that also involved electronics and microphones and so forth, we're going to, I think, lose touch with an entire generation or two of compositional skills and techniques, and how they will inform future composers and audiences will only be through recordings. And I wonder if that is a problem.
Yeah. I mean, it's also reconstructing pieces is also a problem if you have the composer involved, because your own values, your own compositional and musical values change as well. One of the articles in the eContact issue, the special edition that we have coming out with this project, looked at a piece by Keith Hamill. It was a research project where they looked at the portability and being able to bring a piece forward through technologies. So they took a piece by Keith Hamill and started to bring it forward. And the composer was involved in the process and wanted to change things and wanted to set this. And so archiving is a very in the field, it's a very mechanical thing. They say, well, you need to recover the piece and you need to document it. They can't take into account all of the compositional decisions that happened at the moment when you decided, oh yeah, this one actually sounds much better than this one. That kind of stuff is never going to get documented. So no matter how much documentation you have, and this was a huge research team, there were like 5 people, I think, working on this thing over a period of time. And the resources are not available for the most composers to be able to do something like that. And this was one composer and one piece.
One composer, one piece, yeah. A thing I should mention is that you have an association with Cavill St. Damian, which is a little on the sort of unusual side. You have transcribed about 100 of our interviews over the course of the past couple of years, some of them have appeared in a special issue of eContact.
10.2. Yeah.
Yeah. Those and many others will appear on the Cavill St. Damian site. So, with rare exceptions, anything you see transcribed from our interviews on the site will be done by our guest today, Jeff Chippewa.
Ah, I edited them. Actually, Tim Sutton did most of the transcription work for 10.2.
Ah. You edited them, huh?
And I'll go through this one afterwards and make sure that I didn't say anything I shouldn't have.
At least for just transcription purposes.
So a little historical revisionism maybe at work?
Oh, no. Never that. Never that. Let's listen to one more piece, and then we'll come back.
All right.
What shall we hear? Or don't you care?
I don't. It's your call.
Yes, this is Jeff Chippewa here on Calvus and Damien. In the house and on under the road.
Since music is inherently meaningless, meaning being derived through socio-cultural relation, and divergence in norms of perception and in socio-cultural background virtually guarantees a generalized state of miscommunications, attempts to portray meaning in music leads to certain compromise. Dare we ask ourselves if it would not be best to dispense with the art music scene altogether? Since it is there that the greatest misconceptions, misunderstandings, and pretensions exist. Detesting music with violent conviction is certainly preferable to complacently ingesting it and shitting it back out in inane, disinvolved spew. That was an interesting piece, reeking of utter apathy. One of the most decadent facets of the musical situation today is the phenomenal amount of energy and resources spent on exploring the music and performance practices of past eras, the results of which, despite the unfortunately rare presence of particularly sensitive and enlightened interpretations, are doomed to remain anachronistic and incomplete representations. So much effort and breath spent on the unknown. How is it that so many of today's composers, and not these archaeologists, are accused of artistic abstraction? The moment in which one awakens to the implications of the fact of having succumbed to, appropriated the pretenses of any form of dominant serious or high art culture is a decisive one. One can only choose to either plunge unquestioningly into automatism and feed on the work of one's predecessors, or to critically question and attack it with utmost violence that it may be redefined, ensuring its survival and evolution. For those who truly believe in tradition, the choice is obvious and undeniable. Concert music might actually serve a noble purpose if, rather than contributing to a generalized state of conscious ignorance of what exists outside the concert hall, it further engulfed the audience in the ills of our society.
From Gazan.
Was it?
There was that one little place that I really liked.
I thought the pitch was a little, was about half tone.
Sorry. I actually walked into it.
It's supposed to be B flat.
Elena Ungerhauer, who did a lot of work on Stockhausen for a while, lectures and so forth, was meeting in a restaurant with Clarence Barlow. And I knew that they were going to be talking about, because she was giving a lecture on Gazan the next day. So when I walked into this restaurant from the door of the restaurant and started doing the whole vocal that I'd worked up on Gazan, and it was one of the most uncomfortable moments ever I've ever seen, because she was very serious about Stockhausen. You did not mock by doing the vocal.
No Mockhausen here.
No Mockhausen at all. And it was, and Clarence was kind of shrinking back in his chair a little bit, and like, oh no, I don't know this person here. It was a wonderful moment.
Yeah, it's.
But there is a tremendous seriousness about electroacoustics, and I know that we share our membership in the CEC discussion list, which is called CEC something else.
CEC conference.
Conference now, and conversations get very intense about the meaning of the terminology and some of the purposes and some of the ways in which different vocabularies clash. That someone will describe their work as in a certain realm of electroacoustics, and someone else will say, I do this, and there will be kind of a butting of heads. Why is it so intense in electroacoustics? It seems to me, I'll preface that by, or post it, by saying, I don't think it's quite so intense in acoustics. There are arguments, stylistic arguments, but it seems to be very, very intense in electroacoustics.
Where's your sense of humor?
Yeah.
I think it's that you see a lot of these discussions in a public forum with the electroacoustic community. Specifically on this list, I've certainly seen that, and much, 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 much worse amongst acoustic composers. But, you know, you go to any festival in Europe, and just
That's Europe.
Yeah, here in Canada, everything's okay. So we don't talk bad about anything. Everything's all good. It's all good.
That sugar rush.
Canadians are very tolerant. We're a tolerant nation. We're nice people. I think part of it is that you have we're at a point where you can start really defining the larger history, and not the individual histories. You know, the Ircam's history and the Pierre Schaeffer history and the Stockhausen history and the tape music in the United States history. We're at a point where you can start making some sort of synthesis, making comparisons, keeping the distinctions, but finding out, well, this is something that defines the whole generation of all of the electroacoustic music activities that happened in the 70s and all of the in the 80s. We're at a point where you can start to actually have a real, somewhat objective history. You know, there are some good books out that talk about various aspects of the history, but they're all very, very, very centered on certain schools, usually. Or they're too summarical. And it's a problem, because since the 1950s, 1960s, everything is, you know, each sort of line has bifurcated into another and into another and another. So you have all of these parallel lines of activities, somewhat influential, you know, between each other. I think in the midst of all of this, all of these, you know, this plethora of activities, people need to say, well, this is what I do, damn it. That's who I am as a composer. And because otherwise you're sort of floating around randomly in this bath of it. And if you're not comfortable with that, if you want somebody to be able to say, well, I mean, somebody says, what kind of music do you do? Do you want a beer? You know?
I think that's one of the reasons we came up with non-pop, was because nobody knows what the hell it means. And,
yeah,
you
I mean,
know,
it
it's
is.
Like, okay, that's an answer we can give.
It is. It's a huge. Well, it's not a problem. It's very difficult to really define. Well, this is what I do, and I find it funny reading the promotional little things that come out from the techno community and the, you know, the dance. Or, I mean, there's like 500 names, but the thing is, they all seem to know what it means. They all seem to know what it, and then you write your little thing, and it's like, well, it's purplish, green, rhythmic, tonal, romanticism. They have these like seven adjectives, and then maybe they put music at the end or something, and that's supposed to define what they do.
For our listenership, if this is still on the web by the time you listen, and I don't mean this broadcast, but rather the thing I'm about to refer to, Ishtar's Guide to Electronic Music.
Yeah,
is one of the not only most complete, but also one of the funniest.
It's got to be taken a bit tongue-in-cheek. It seems to be quite good, though.
Hundreds of different genres.
With examples.
With examples of each one, and sometimes, you know,
I always like the German trash industrial
yes.
something or other.
You know, and you'll go through, you know, sub this. It almost sounds like kind of like Protestant sects.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there'll be
Protestant
this
sex.
One. No, they don't have that. I mean,
oh, okay.
S-E-C-T-S.
Oh, sects, right.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. And you'll have those through the Protestants. They'll be divided into this and that and then into another until you get down to like a church which is unique with two people in it.
Yeah.
And they are their own division of subdivision of a subdivision. And sometimes
and complain because there's no audience.
Yeah, yes. And that's the same thing with the electroacoustics.
Why doesn't anybody like us?
Anyway. Well, there you go. I think that's we got a pretty good background on some of that. What else? Anything else we can talk about, or are we?
Hey, congratulations on getting rid of Bush. I mean, you never really had him in the first place, officially, but...
How about your pilot's license? Should we talk about that?
No, but I'm getting my driver's license tomorrow.
Oh, okay. I wonder if it was one of those.
Well, it expired. I had to do all the tests.
Yeah, he tried to give us directions to get here.
They were spectacular, though, weren't they?
The good part was once we got in the building, we found where we had to go.
Yeah.
Before that, forget it.
Our guest spent so much time and effort writing all these directions, and then he responded saying, only with the address of the thing, on De Maisonneuve. And he said, thanks, that's all I need. I went outside, I went up to the building, I asked the security, where's that parking and this, I went look down the street at the red building, the big glass building, when you can park on the corner, go across in the right lane, and he says, 1515 to Maisonneuve, thanks.
Yeah, okay.
That worked, and here we are. Jeff Chippewa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
They're coming for us. They're coming.
All right, we wrap it up with two pieces by Jeff Chippewa. The first is Plastic in the Freiburg version, and the last one is Al Talone.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.